So the interesting thing about Chris Schumacher is he has deep self-knowledge.
Yeah.
And even as many times as we've been together with him, he never doesn't return like all the way to the core of the feeling. Like he can still feel the feeling, which I know from like, say, having breast cancer and having written a book about it and then talked about it a lot, that I can't always feel the story.
Right.
But he's never not in touch with the feeling of remorse or contrition around his crime. Like he can always sink back in. Or maybe he would say, I couldn't even escape it. I couldn't even not feel it, yeah. Which is what's so special about him. And it was so fascinating to see him on our stage with Lance Armstrong, who was so different and in such a different place in terms of his self-knowledge and his experience with regret.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I'm glad I got an opportunity to just sort of say... some people don't want to forgive him.
I know.
And they'll say it to me.
Yeah.
And they're allowed to say that.
Yeah.
I think they're wrong, but that's what people think. I mean, right. A lot of people are like, he killed someone. Like, what do you want me to do?
Right. Right. He's done. It's over.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
don't praise him.
Right.
Like, don't, like, let him go suffer a little bit.
Right.
Now, I think if they knew the truth, they'd feel like I think, but that's an arrogant statement on my part. But I wanted him just to have an opportunity to respond to that.
Yeah. So this is a podcast with Chris Schumacher, who's done a lot of things in the last year in his personal life and also with the Nantucket Project. And every time we spend time with him, yeah, we want to spend more time with him. And you'll see why as you listen. But he really is, he's fascinating, and he's totally open about the journey he's on and the many switchbacks. And there's just a lot to learn by knowing him. There's a lot to learn by knowing Chris Schumacher.
He has done and he does do the work. He's just one of those guys, because the way he speaks and the way he responds to things, you can't do that unless you work on it a lot.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
It's not, we're not the first people to ask him these questions or think these things. He's been through this many times.
Yeah. So this is Chris Schumacher. Enjoy.
So I met Chris Schumacher in San Quentin Prison in the fall of 2016. I had been brought there by my friend Lindsay Beck, a Nantucket Project former award winner and speaker, who had a program there that she was working with called The Last Mile. And when I met Chris, it was clear to me that he was very lucid and very clear in who he was, what he had done, and how to live a life. Some of that was through the words he said. Some of that was through his being. I could feel it. And that night, I flew to Southern California to go to a big bank summit of the biggest entrepreneurs in America. And what I couldn't get out of my head was, this guy, Chris Schumacher, who I met in San Quentin prison, seemed more balanced and happy, you know, content, hopeful, than anybody I met down in Southern California at the fancy gathering of the most powerful entrepreneurs in America. And you know, Chris was later let out of jail. We brought him to the Nantucket Project, and he told an amazing story. So today, Kelly and I have an opportunity to have a conversation with the guy who I've subsequently met many times, but I met inside a prison a year and a half ago. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thank you for having me. Hi, Tom. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. So you got out of prison 6 months ago or more?
Oh, my gosh. It was actually May the 4th, 2017. Turned out it was Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you.
And you had been in prison, not just San Quentin, but several prisons before that, since 2000?
Yes, I was incarcerated June 26th of 2000. I was sentenced to a 16-year-to-life sentence for murder. During my incarceration, I made a decision that I wanted to take accountability for the crime that I had committed. I wanted to find a way to move forward. For me, that was getting clean and sober while I was inside. It was turning my life towards a spiritual path. And over the course of 17 years, I was able to go back to school and earn a college degree. I was able to get involved with a program called The Last Mile, which started out as an entrepreneurship class and then later turned into a web development course. And so all of these things, I feel like, helped shape me as a person. So when I did go to the parole board in 2016 and I was able to show them who I had become, they finally said, "Mr. Schumacher, we find you suitable for release."
Oh, wow. And you had been up for parole. You had been up before them once before, right?
I had. My first
hearing. And they did not find you suitable at that time.
No, my first hearing was in 2015 in California. It's incredibly difficult for somebody who had committed a capital crime to get found suitable. And I felt like I went into that hearing and had done everything right. And took ownership of it and took accountability, but at the end of the day, it just wasn't time yet. They denied me for 3 years, which is the minimal length of denial in California. It goes all the way up to 15 years. But with the three-year denial, if you stay out of trouble and do everything right, they can call you back early. So I was called back within 18 months, and at my second parole board hearing, 4.5 hours later, they found me suitable for release.
What did you talk about in those 4.5 hours? What did they ask you?
They want you to talk about the crime. They want to hear your version of it. And really what they want is for you to take ownership of it, for you to take accountability, to say, yeah, that's who I was at the time. For me, it was a selfish, self-centered drug addict, drug dealer. Someone who was more concerned about my image than I was human life. And they want to see that you can show remorse for that, right? That you genuinely feel sorry for what you have done. And anybody can say that, like, I'm sorry for this or I'm sorry for that. But really what I attempted to do during my entire incarceration was show that through a changed life.
How soon after you did it, did you start to feel remorse?
Oh my gosh. I want to say immediately, and I want to say it was an ongoing process of just really understanding how big of a harm that I had caused, because it wasn't just taking my friend's life, Morgan, over a suitcase full of drugs. You know, I realized that Morgan had an aunt and a daughter, and a family who loved him. There was the community, you know, of Hollywood that I was living in, that when a murder happens, everyone gets harmed and affected by it. And then in addition to that, there was my own family who never in their wildest dreams thought that I would do something like this and end up in prison. In terms of magnitude, my crime hurt a lot of people, and it was really a process for me of learning about it and understanding and taking accountability in a way that really tries to bring healing to the entire situation as much as possible.
On the day that you killed Morgan, had you ever been close to killing another person again before?
No.
Like in your wildest dreams, could you have ever done something like that?
In my wildest dreams, no. I mean, I didn't even wake up that day thinking that was on the spectrum of possibilities. And I look back now and I wish I had. I wish I had paid more attention to the warning signs in my life and in my addiction and in the choices that I was making. I mean, there's a lot of regret. For me, not being able to stop that sooner, and you know, every day I wish I could go back and have made a different choice.
You know, Chris, when I hear your story, there really is only one unique part of it from my perspective, which is murder. You know, to hear you speak, I've heard plenty of people in the world of recovery speak on these matters or things like it. And, you know, they sort of come from this place with a total lack of clarity. And then they move to a place of clarity. And along the path is you sort of recognize the truth behind the choices you made and the relationship between the choices you made. And as humans, how to deal with those choices. Many people just continue to abuse substances as a way to sort of get through the day. So one of the things that comes up, and it relates to that one difference, is when I tell your story, and I've told your story many times, it fairly often, I would say not in a majority of the cases, but certainly in a fair number of the cases, you know, people sort of question my willingness to forgive you. I mean, you don't owe me anything, so in some ways that's meaningless, but how do you feel about that? How would you answer people like that who would say, the guy's a frickin' murderer, why are you so impressed with who he is? How do you respond to that?
Wow, that's such an interesting question, because I mean, forgiveness comes from so many different places, and I realize that there are people that may never forgive me for what I have done. I thought that those people would have started with Morgan's family. And even at my parole board hearings, both of them, the district attorney invites the family to come and talk about their experience and maybe weigh in on whether or not I should be released from parole. And at neither of those hearings, anyone showed up. Before the hearing, I was provided the opportunity to write letters of remorse and apology to Morgan's family. And you can't mail it to them directly, but I was able to mail it to the Office of Victim Services, so if the family ever did want to receive those letters, they could contact them. And to this day, I still don't know if they ever did. You know, I think that I've had to learn to forgive myself, to move forward, to realize that it's how important it is not to let our past define who we are or the potential that we have. And that forgiveness really came from a spiritual place for me, because if God can forgive me, then I felt like I had to forgive myself. And if there was any hope of me ever being productive or helping others in the future, I mean, I think that's where my energy needed to be focused.
You know, that, so what you just described, it's huge. You know, this is big, what we're talking about here, and you talked about forgiving yourself. You know, part of, and I'm imagining this, so I'm thinking aloud, and I'm interested in your reaction to what I'm going to say. You know, part of it is, there must be this, it happened, right? And after one day, it happened. After 2 days, it still happened. After a year, it still happened. After 2 years, it still happened. That's never going away, that this thing happened, right? It's there. It's kind of always there. It's unchangeable. And I would imagine there's a certain amount of that, which is like a certain kind of fatigue. And it's sort of, I must accept that this thing happened in order for me to sort of cope and go forward. So, you know, and again, this is me imagining what I might do in your shoes. But then you brought up the other thing, which is, for you, God. How quickly did you get there? And what does that mean? Like, try to answer that question for somebody who has no idea what you're talking about, and might think of what you just said as hocus pocus. Because, you know, to the extent that lots of people hear this, some number of them are going to think what you just said is hocus pocus. I'm just curious how you would react to that. So it's sort of the acceptance side of your ability to forgive yourself, and then the spiritual side of your ability to forgive yourself.
Yeah. I mean, the acceptance part is I had to accept what I did. And for the forgiveness part is an ongoing process every day, and I don't think it's ever going to be 100% complete. The Bible teaches that we're all sinners and that we've all fallen short of the grace of God. And if it wasn't for His forgiveness and the salvation in Him, that none of us would be saved or forgiven. And that's where I put my faith. That's where I put my trust, that if God can forgive me being a sinner, someone who has taken the life of another human being, if He can forgive me, then what right do I have not to forgive myself?
Yeah. Well, you did say, and I'm thinking aloud, and I'm not trying to be difficult. You also just said you don't know that you could forgive yourself entirely. Those might not have been the exact words you used, but you said something to that effect. Doesn't that in turn then relate to a certain extent of how much faith you might have? Because based on what I just heard you say, if you had 100% faith, you 100% should forgive yourself. If you have 99% faith, maybe only 99% you'd be able to forgive yourself. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm just curious how you think about that.
I mean, it sounds like a scale where you weigh all the good stuff and you weigh all the bad stuff. I know my faith in God is real, and I know that, like, living with the fact that I committed this crime, that I took Morgan's life, is a daily struggle in forgiving myself, because I have good days where I can continue to move forward, and then I have days where I reflect on the past and, like, really think, who was that person, and what right do I have to move forward? And thankfully for me, there's more good days than bad days. But I can never make it go away. Like you said, it will never unhappen. And I get to make the choice on a daily basis on how I'm going to move forward. And for me, that means transparency, and that means honesty, and that means talking about it, because I feel like even in the tragedy of this story, that there might be healing in it for others. If anybody can learn, while I was at San Quentin, I took part in a program called Squires, where we were actually mentoring at-risk youth, dealing with things like gangs and drugs and alcohol and peer pressure. And if any of my story could help prevent them from ever going down the same path, then, I mean, I feel like that's part of my process of making amends and forgiving myself.
You know, that I appreciated how you put it, that you know, there are good days and bad days, because I know it is true for me. I can't imagine that anyone listening right now doesn't sort of have those things in their soul where they wish they had never done that thing, and that they do sort of struggle with their ability to forgive themselves through that process. And I don't think I've ever met the person, and I'm going to give one potential exception to this in a moment, who can do it all the way. You know, they have to sort of work on a daily basis to sort of get back to that place. Now, the person I was going to say is Nadia Bolz Weber, who talks about the fact that she is both 100% sinner and saint simultaneously at all times, and that regret is just a waste of energy. That's been really helpful to me. Like, I find that really powerful. I mean, Chris, you know, you and I have spent time together. You've been with all of us. You've spoken on our stage. You've had a big impact on me. And that has had a very big impact on me, is like the notion that you can be comfortable in your transgression life by virtue of the fact that that's who you are. I mean, these are facts. I mean, part of what I was hearing in your story, especially in the beginning, is the first thing you kind of have to do is come to terms with the truth. Like, the truth is, this is what happened. The truth is, you injured him and others. I have injured, you know, people and others. And then once that truth is sort of staring you in the face, how do you deal with it? Well, one of the ways might just be truth. It might be a recognition of the truth of the fact that humans aren't perfect. We're both things at once. And that, in just knowledge of that fact, might help you go through life more capable of forgiving and serving others. Because that was the other part of what I heard you just say, is that it in turn drives you to help others, which in turn helps you
heal.
Yeah,
you seem to me like a person who's gonna be working on making it right every day for the rest of your life by making yourself useful. Like, that's, you're gonna do yourself out of this. You know what I mean? Instead of thinking yourself out of it or feeling yourself out of it, you're doing things to make amends all the time. And I want you to tell people about that workshop that you went to in San Quentin where they helped you describe your personal history in a way that facilitated the kind of responsibility you're talking about.
Sure. And thank you. I hope that I'm making a contribution each and every day. I mean, that is part of who I'm trying to be. And a lot of that did come from inside prison. I was transferred to San Quentin in 2007. And of course, it's got a notorious reputation, being one of the oldest prisons in California, home of death row. It was super violent in the 80s, but when I arrived there in 2007, it had gone from a level 4 institution to a level 2 institution, where they had started to institute a lot of rehabilitative programs. One program that I got involved with was the Victim Offenders Education Group. And when I'd first heard about it, I heard that, you know, you go through a 18-month long curriculum, and at the very end, you sit on what they call a survivors panel, where they bring in survivors of crime and they try to match the survivors with the crimes that you committed and have a dialogue with them. And you get to tell your story of how you ended up in prison, and they get to tell their stories of how someone else had impacted them or harmed or murdered one of their family members. And when I first got there, I'm like, there is no way in hell I'm going to take this class, because why am I going to subject myself to, you know, the onslaught of the pain and the suffering that these people had gone through? And so I stayed away from that group for a really long time, until I changed cells and got a new cellmate. His name was Robert Fry, and he was facilitating. He was one of the inmate facilitators for this group, and he goes, look, man, I think you should really give it a chance. There's a lot to be learned there. And so I finally enrolled and got signed up. And one of the first exercises they ask you to do is write down all of the details of your crime, from the day it happened to the thoughts that you were thinking, to the people you think you harmed, to the why you thought it happened. And up until that point, you know, I'd spent the first 7 years of my incarceration where nobody talks about their crime in a real open or honest way. Anytime a guy talks about his crime on the yard, it's filled with a lot of bravado and a lot of self-justification, a lot of, oh, they had it coming, or it wasn't me. So you never got the real story. And sitting down in this group and writing out this exercise and then sharing it in a small group of men, 10 men sitting in a circle with a few outside and inside facilitators, you open your soul and you open your, you know, you just become really vulnerable in a way that generally doesn't happen in prison. And then you get feedback.
Or in regular life, I might add. I mean, civilians don't really do that either with their much lesser crimes.
Very fair. And I agree. So, and then you get feedback. And as you go around and as each man shares his story and gets feedback from the other men, you start to build this level of trust where you feel like you can start being real and open and more transparent. And I mean, that was a transforming experience for me to go in there and start talking about my crime and not saying, oh, the day that I committed my crime to the day that I murdered Morgan. It's a whole different level of taking accountability. It's calling it what it is and really owning it. You know, the language that we use accountable language is so important. Whether, you know, how many have you guys have heard, like, oh, I caught a case, you know, like you were catching a common cold. You didn't catch a case, you know, you robbed or you stole or you murdered. And when you...
The other thing, sorry, keep going.
Yeah, you know, like, I just feel like when you own it that way and other people hear it, I feel like that's where the true healing and forgiveness can begin. Because when you understand what you've done, then it allows other people to kind of show empathy and show understanding as well.
Yeah, and the incredible thing is that if you're in a circle of people and say someone else goes first, and a man in your cell or your group tells you, goes, you know, kind of blow by blow into their crime, and you feel in your own heart some empathy and understanding for that person, then like that's the first moment where you're sure that another person might be able to feel that for you. Because until you feel, until you've like loved someone who has made a terrible mistake or cared for someone or understood someone who's done something terrible, then you don't really believe someone would love or care for you if they knew what you had done. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, and I agree with that too.
Like you weren't revolted by the other people in a way that you perhaps were afraid they would be repulsed by you and your crime. You know what I mean?
Right. And it's interesting because like when you hold on to stuff or secrets, sometimes you can feel like you were the only one with that secret or that thought. And when you open up and start sharing it with other people, you give people the opportunity to connect, and you also give them permission to open up in ways too that maybe they've been holding on to stuff. So I think there is something very powerful in sharing stories and sitting in circles.
So did you, I mean, that's the whole neighborhood project right there, but
right.
Did you do the part of that 18-month program where people who had lost someone to murder came and told their story and you had to sort of receive it and observe it and internalize it?
I did. It was actually 23 months later. Ours was the extended Victims Offenders Education Group. But after 23 months, they brought in two survivors. One had been sexually assaulted, and another one had been the mother of her son who had gotten murdered. And it was 2 days. And the first day that the guys on the inside shared their story over 8 hours, and it was held in the chapel and it was held in a circle. And they absorbed all of our stories and they heard all of us taking accountability and sharing in our stories in a way that they had probably never heard before. And then the second day we got to hear their stories, and there was tears shed. There was hearts breaking and opening at the same time. I think there was understanding on both sides of, you know, I can just speak for myself, is one, realizing, you know, the harm that I'd caused from someone else's perspective, and two, them seeing that I was doing everything in my power to try to take accountability for what I had done. So it was transforming in a way that I attribute a lot of when I went to the parole board and was able to talk about the crime and take ownership of it. I think all of it had to do with that experience.
You know, as I hear you talk, I'll do my best here, and if I fumble, I'll try again the next time. I can very much identify, or I, to a certain extent, I can identify with a lot of what you're saying. I've experienced things like this in my life through conversation. And in many ways, the words are insufficient to describe what's happening. And that's the part that I want to just try to think about. Because really what we're talking about is there's this, the process of going through this creates this thing that never existed before. When some of it, I think, is a recognition of truth, because that truth was always there. You know, if these acts are forgivable, they were always forgivable. If part of to make these acts forgivable, they must be understood. It was always there. It was really for you to come to understand it. And through conversation, which, you know, some of it is the words, some of it is the expression, some of it is the respect, the presence. Like, there's so many parts that sort of come into play here that in the end transform you into something that you didn't even know you were looking for. I mean, you might have thought, hey, I need a solution to my problem. I respect that. But the way you sort of get from one place to the next, these are really hard things to describe and really hard things to understand. But I can feel it in your voice. Like, I can feel as you describe it that just the power and the irreplaceability, and that's really the key here, is that I just don't think you could read your way through this. You can't, you know, lift weights your way through this. You can't take a drug to get through this. What we're talking about is sort of fundamentally such a critical human act that is, I think, misunderstood. Misunderstood, I know, by me. If you could have never told me that some of the challenges I've had in my life, the worst challenges I've had in my life, for me, were only solvable through what you just said. And I think for you, I'm speaking out of school a little bit here. I'm not sure you had any other answer here. I don't think there's any other choice to help you solve your problem than to experience these kinds of things. And in turn, by the way, importantly, help to whatever extent you can the victims too. Like, they need you to do this for them, and maybe often unbeknownst to them. If that makes sense, you know, if the world's going to get better, if you're going to be a help other people, I'm not sure there's any other method than for you to experience these kinds of things to get from one place to the next. Does that make sense to you?
It totally makes sense. And I agree. You know, I think it was a gift that I landed in that circle, or I finally, was brave enough to take that step or, directed on that path, but I'm thankful for it too. I mean, because that kind of work really is challenging. It's not easy, and it's not for the faint of heart. You know, for
me, is that something that's available at other prisons?
It is. It started at San Quentin, and now it's starting to expand to other institutions within California. I think there's even talk about expanding, you know, across the country as well, just because it is such a solid curriculum and a solid program.
Do you hope to meet his family one day and have an opportunity to sort of express the way things are now?
Oh my gosh, right when you said that, I felt two different things right at the same time. One is hell no, and you know, because that would just be putting the mirror on me all over again. And at the same time, if that could provide them any healing, if that could, you know, that's not something, it wouldn't be for me, you know, but if that could bring healing, if that could ease pain, if that could make sense of something that was so senseless, I would do it. I feel like that's what I owe. You know, I believe that that's part of my burden that I'll carry with me for the rest of my life. And so I would say yes to that.
What are the bad parts of not being in jail? Like, I'm trying to imagine, like, it's probably all fun and games in the beginning. Maybe it's always fun and games, but I'm just curious. Like, are you think, like, ah, you know, I'm not... I'm more distracted than I used to be, or I'm more stressed than I used to be. Like, what's different? What's worse is really what I'm asking.
What's worse about being free?
Yeah.
Is that what you just said?
Yeah. Yes.
You know, people ask me when I first got out, they're like, what's the biggest change, or what's the thing that's just blown you away more than anything? Is it the food? You know, the food's obviously better out here. Is it the people? Is it technology? Is technology blowing you away? I mean, for me, the hardest part is leaving people that I really cared about behind, the friends that I made. I was at San Quentin for over a decade, and it was a pretty small fishbowl of a yard, you know, maybe 2,000 men that you go to school with and you work with and you live in the same building with. And it really was a community, you know, not with everybody, you know, because everybody's doing their own thing. And then there's people that are committed and on a path to self-improvement. And those are the people that I miss the most, and I think are the most deserving of another chance. There's not a night that goes by that I don't pray that their time comes soon. And I think that's one thing that I miss out here, is I don't think I'll ever have that closeness, that sense of community that I did while I was in there.
Are you allowed to talk to them?
No.
No.
A few weeks ago, the last mile, I had a demo day and a graduation. And as one of the returned citizens and one of the graduates of the program, I was invited to go back into San Quentin. And I could have told you that before I left, or before I was released, and I'd heard about these opportunities where guys come back in and talk about, you know, life on the outside and show people how they're doing. I would have said, hell no, I don't want to be one of those guys. I worked too hard, you know, over the course of 17 years to get released. Why on earth would I ever want to come back in? And so when I was invited to this demo day, those thoughts went through my head, and I saw how the program had been expanding, you know, the web development program. It went from one classroom with 18 men in it to five different classrooms, and is now in six different prisons in California. They're in two women's prisons in a juvenile facility. And this program is directly responsible for me becoming a software engineer in San Francisco for a company called Fandom. I was able to take the training that I had gotten while inside and parlay that into an internship and a full-time job. So I definitely felt a lot of gratitude and humility, and felt like that if I had a way to give back to them and give hope to those guys still on the inside who are going through the program, that I actually went back inside. And that was such a surreal experience, because now I was walking in as a free man. I was coming in through the front gate. I gave them my driver's license like everybody else that was walking through the front door. It didn't say Chris Schumacher T31014, you know, it said Chris Schumacher and the company that I worked for. And when I walked inside, I saw so many of these friends that I left behind, and it was great to see them. And also at the same time, in my heart, I knew that wasn't my place to be anymore. So I spent a few hours, talked to a lot of people, saw the construction that they had unveiled. I mean, it's amazing what the last mile has done inside San Quentin. And when I left that day, I think that's going to be my last trip.
You know, I think the night before, you were at our house for dinner, and I was wondering if you were going to really go through with it, if you were going to show up that next day. I just thought it'd be too much. It'd be too hard. It'd be too, I don't know, you're in street clothes, and you've just moved so far from that place. And I wondered if you would see George. Wasn't George the one that was you felt really close to?
Jorge.
Jorge, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You give him the English version. But yeah, Jorge, he was not there that day. He got caught up in a situation through no fault of his own. Is currently in the hole. You know, and it's too much to go into right now, but I mean, even on your best day in San Quentin, when you're doing everything right, you're still in an environment where things happen and you get caught up in the mix and you suffer the consequences. You know, they have a saying in there that if one person breaks a dish, everybody pays for it. And I think Jorge got caught up in something, and he was scheduled to go to parole board in June. And because he went to the hole and was under investigation, they had to postpone his hearing for a year, while he tries to get his name cleared. And, he's in the middle of it right now, and it breaks my heart.
I'm sorry.
But
hey, Chris.
Yeah.
I'm curious. When you think about sort of crime and punishment in the United States, or let's say California, because that's from the one you're most familiar with, I guess, but maybe you could speak to it broadly. How do you feel about it? Like, how do you feel about our system? How do you feel about, you know, I think about you and the guys I met inside the last mile, but then, you know, there's another 1,950 other people who aren't in that. I don't know the exact numbers, but how do you feel about the system overall?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of crime and punishment, I feel like people that commit crimes should be punished. I felt like for what I did, I deserved every bit of my 16-year life sentence. And then once inside the system, I wish there was more in terms of rehabilitation and education and classes on emotional intelligence and learning how to take accountability. I mean, I feel like these are all of the things that helped shape me and helped make me ready to come back out here and be a productive citizen. I feel like I was very lucky to get to San Quentin, because out of the 35 prisons in California, not all of them are like that. Not all of them are in the Bay Area, where over 400 volunteers come in on a weekly basis to facilitate some of these programs. So I think it's much more difficult for that rehabilitation and that change to happen for men in other prisons. I know things are changing. 2 weeks ago, I was invited to an employers conference in Sacramento, where I actually shared a table with Governor Jerry Brown. You know, I was in jeans and sweater and a button-down shirt, and he looked over and he nodded at me. And then when the show began, they showed a video from one of the Last Miles demo day while I was on the inside, in my blue shirt and, you know, state blues. And he looked over at me and did a double take, and it was the most funny thing that I've ever seen. Because, I mean, for him, the contrast was stark. And but that day, I'd never heard, you know, and it started with the governor, and it went to the CDCR, or the secretary of the CDCR, to the general manager of PIA, and they were all talking about implementing more programs and finding ways to alleviate the over-incarceration in California and in the country by finding ways for guys to earn their way out earlier. And I mean, that was something that I had prayed for the whole time I was down, because when I was first incarcerated, you know, everybody said, don't take a plea bargain for life, because life means life. And at the time, it did. You know, they were letting very few lifers go. So to see that change over the course of my incarceration, and then also to be able to sit at the table and hear these men talk about the plans that they had to implement the programs in the inside, and then it was also to show employers on the outside what was possible and to encourage them to hire more men upon the return. So, you know, I say all that to say that it's a process. It doesn't move as fast as I personally would like. I think more can be done, but it does give me hope.
Can I think of you as such a special person, and I wonder if, like, are you an anomaly in terms of San Quentin, or are there 100 other guys just like you who are forward-facing, who would do anything, would go through any emotional, intellectual exercise to get better and be more ready to be a productive citizen? Like, how representative are you?
That's a good question. I mean, it's hard to say because I was only at a limited number of prisons, you know, 3 prisons total. But during my time at San Quentin, I saw many men who inspired me to work harder and to be better. So I definitely don't think I'm the only one. And I saw many men after me. And in a way, we're our own best resource while on the inside of learning, you know, how to take accountability, on understanding, you know, what it is we're feeling and what it is we're thinking, and how it guides our actions and behaviors. And I think there's a lot more to follow too. I think as the culture inside changes from lock them up and throw away the key to learning and growing and evolving, I think it has the ability to spread, you know.
You know, my impression that day, and this is totally unscientific, but in thinking about Kelly's question, you know, I met several really inspiring people in there. You know, clearly these were the special people within the system, which is how they ended up in that room in the first place. But I was impressed. I mean, I was sort of impressed with what I saw. But I had a conversation recently. I have a friend who's facing jail time, and she's very much looking at how we do crime and punishment in the United States, and on the list of the objectives is revenge. Like, revenge is part of the deal. It's very human. I would prefer we wouldn't do it that way, but I'm sympathetic to people who've been victim of crimes or people who have to sort of establish order. I'm sort of walking both sides of the fence here. I think it's a really interesting issue. But the other observation that I had leaving that day is there are also people within that I saw and experienced that day who, you know, the size of your muscles, the tattoos you have, the men you're hanging out with, the bravado, the don't disrespect me, like, that's the education they're getting. Like, that's what they're being taught, and they're teaching each other on a day-to-day basis, which, you know, I happen to think that's less than good as a way to think. I also happen to think it's these men come out and they educate people on the outside and they learn things that way. So I have to, speaking for myself, I wish we had a more, I would say, practical, loving approach to people who should pay a penalty. I agree with you, like, sentences are what they are. Maybe some of them aren't exactly right, but, you know, I've dealt with many people in the addiction community who commit crimes and they sort of say, well, I'm getting better now, why should I have to go serve my sentence? Like, well, you did a crime, that's why. And if you didn't have that sentence, you might not be in recovery right now. You might have just kept using drugs and alcohol. So it's very interesting. It's a very interesting question. And, you know, it's politically speaking, it's so easy for people to stand up and say, put them in jail. You know, mm-hmm. You got other things to worry about. Like, let's get rid of these people.
But your interesting statement, Chris, is put them in jail and then rehabilitate them. Like, I remember the first time I met you saying, what saved you? And you said, San Quentin saved me.
Yeah. Yeah, there was so much going on there in terms of education, you know, going back to school. There was a college program there. There was a veterans group. That I took part in. You know, I was in the United States Air Force, got kicked out for drinking, and I was able to take part in that group while at San Quentin and did far more for the service than I ever did while I was on the inside. You know, we were packing boxes for troops overseas. We were doing fundraisers, earning money to send children of veterans to college. There was just a lot of opportunity to not only learn, but also to give back. I think that's one of the things that, you know, even on my worst day, you know, I always found like you could feel better doing something for somebody else. It took a lot of the focus and energy off of myself, you know, and where I was at, and helped me feel like I was worth something. It sounds like the weirdest thing to me to say, but it's absolutely true, is that prison is the best thing that ever happened to me.
Well, we're lucky to know you. Thanks for doing this with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. First of all, love the Nantucket Project. You know, I think there's something powerful in the way that you're sharing stories with the world. And so I'm just grateful to take part.
Right on.
Thank you, Chris. It's always great.
Good. Are we wrapped?
Talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
What? No enchilada tacos? All right. I'm just kidding.
Next time. All right. Talk to you.
This podcast and the Neighborhood Project are powered by the Nantucket Project.